From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. With just 16 days left in the Trump administration, the president is poised to leave the White House the same way he entered, in controversy. During a call between President Trump and Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger on Saturday, the president appeared to threaten the Secretary of State with prosecution if he didn't back up Trump's false claim that election fraud cost him victory in the state.
Look, all I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, because we won the state.
And today, at least one of the Republicans who's planning to challenge the formal certification of the vote in Congress on Wednesday is defending the president's call. This morning, Texas Senator Ted Cruz tweeted, quote, "We have a responsibility to follow the law and to protect the integrity of our elections." Joining us is Georgia Public Broadcasting's Stephen Fowler, who was one of the first reporters to obtain the audio of that phone call. Stephen, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
Yeah, sure. And Raffensperger recorded this call because he says he has been asked by Trump supporters to do illegal things to change the election results. And we have to point out that Republicans may be talking about the integrity of this election, but the vote in Georgia was counted three times.
Yeah, I mean, it took me a second to really just let it sink in that, yes, Georgia's votes have been counted three times. And we had the original count. We had a hand audit where 5 million paper ballots were counted by hand, and then a machine recount, which saw those 5 million ballots counted for a third time. And part of this is because Georgia got a new voting system where a paper ballot was added to the process in situations like these where there are questions about close races and who won. And it's really remarkable that even with this new system in place and with those numerous counts, that there are still questions about who won.
Yeah, from some through people. All this, Raffensperger, a Republican, has held strong and defended the integrity of that election. Here he is speaking to ABC News this morning about the phone call.
The data that he has is just plain wrong. He had hundreds and hundreds of people he said that were dead that voted. We found two. That's an example of just he has bad data.
So that's Raffensperger. What are other Georgia Republican Party officials saying about the call?
Well, Governor Brian Kemp, who himself has been under attack from the president for not doing enough to overturn the election, called it a distraction from the Senate election runoffs that are happening on Tuesday. Senator Kelly Loeffler on the campaign trail this morning called it actually didn't address it at all and said she's only focusing on the runoffs. The chair of the Georgia Republican Party, who has been an outspoken supporter of Trump, said it was disturbing to him that Secretary Raffensperger recorded and leaked the call and said that that just wasn't cool. So you're really getting mixed signals from kind of what represents the one wing of the Republican Party and the potential other wing of what could happen moving forward.
We also saw the influential conservative radio host and Trump critic Eric Erickson write today that the president could sabotage Georgia, referring there to the Senate runoff races, and get indicted, which, you know, the context that this election is coming up tomorrow, I think, is very important. Talk more about that. How much does all of this complicate the race?
Right. So you have to look no further than Georgia's early voting data. 3 million people have already cast a ballot in the race, and that's going to be the majority of the votes. You look at where those votes are coming from, and you see that maybe the president's words have had impact. You see strong turnout in rural Southwest Georgia, which is home to a large portion of Black Democratic voters. You look at Metro Atlanta, which leans Democratic, that has a heavy turnout. And the place where people aren't voting is in North Georgia, two congressional districts that are strong Republican strongholds. And for it to work, President Trump is rallying in North Georgia tonight, and he's going to have to encourage an overwhelming Election Day turnout to be able to beat the Democrats' early vote advantage. And that's why you see Kelly Loeffler, who's locked in a tight battle with Democrat Raphael Warnock, that's why you see her not commenting on this when she's out on the campaign trail and really trying to avoid fanning the flames even further.
Stephen Fowler covers politics for Georgia Public Broadcasting. I know you'll be busy today, later tonight, and tomorrow. So thank you for taking the time to speak with us. It's an important story. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, as the nation listened to President Trump's phone call over the weekend, the U.S. surpassed 350,000 deaths from the coronavirus. And here are some other numbers to put this in perspective. It took the nation about 200 days to reach the 5 million mark in cases. This time around, we've gone from 15 to 20 million cases in just 25 days. And now there is this new threat posed by that more contagious variant of COVID-19. Let's bring in Dr. Saskia Popescu, an epidemiologist at George Mason University, with the latest. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start with getting the vaccine into the arms of Americans. We're seeing reports of slow rollouts and wasted doses and healthcare workers who are hesitant to get the shot. What part of this process are you most concerned about right now?
I think there's a lot of moving pieces. Unfortunately, you know, vaccine distribution at a population size is a monumental task. This is no easy feat. And there's been so much politicization of this pandemic and really of this vaccine development from the outgoing administration that I think people are naturally very hesitant, which is something we're working to combat. So the U.S., through, you know, the Warp Speed Initiative, really wanted to administer 20 million doses within the month of December. And we've really only been able to do about 4.2 million. So we're really behind. And part of the challenge is it's not just distributing the vaccines. It's actually getting them, as you mentioned, into the arms of people. And that takes a lot of coordination. And what we are seeing across many states is everywhere from people unable to use the computer systems that the health departments have worked with to try and get registered to even being notified. You know, in Arizona, where I'm from, there were some situations where people with certain email accounts would never get a response back or were told to go to very far distribution sites. So lots of moving pieces, lots of room for error.
Well, the Trump administration is blaming the states for the slow rollout. What is the federal government doing to help coordinate this nationwide response?
I think the hard part is that we really did need strong federal leadership to initiate this rollout and to support states. So, you know, I hate to put the blame on states because this is such a huge task and it happening at such a fast speed that it's not surprising we're having some logistical errors. Part of the challenge is, though, you know, we're likely not going to be getting strong federal support until the new administration comes in, which, you know, weeks away. But in the meantime, yes, states need resources. They need not only stronger distribution plans, but personnel. You know, in Arizona right now, 4 out of 5 doses haven't been used, and we're struggling to just get enough public health workers to make it happen. So 100%, we need more resources.
Well, what steps do you think should be taken right now to accelerate this?
I think the first piece is really having a much more widespread communication and science education campaign so that healthcare workers are not as hesitant to get them. They know what any side effects might be in their reporting systems. So that's the first piece, because we are seeing a lot of vaccine hesitation, and that's not something that we want to get, you know, reinforced by the distribution challenges we're experiencing right now. So I think that's the biggest one, but also providing the resources in terms of personnel to states for distribution so that we're not stressing those healthcare workers, because hospitals are major distribution sites right now. So, you know, I also think ultimately a national strategy, which the CDC and NIH have provided some information, but they need just a little bit more in terms of how to logistically roll something out at even the most small level. You know, how do you create and distribute a website so that people can register and know when they're available to get a vaccine? You know, this was something that the District of Columbia, New Mexico put together. They did portals, which I think was an amazing strategy, so that people could go in, could sign up and say, okay, I will be notified when I can get my vaccine, when I qualify for it, versus some states like Florida and, you know, and even Arizona, where I'm from, are struggling for people to even know when they're available, when they can get them. So resources, both in terms of personnel and, you know, even electronic, are important.
And, you know, on top of all of this, California and Colorado and Florida have reported cases of this new, more infectious variant of the coronavirus. Some health officials say by March, all new cases of COVID could actually be this new variant. I mean, it doesn't appear to be more deadly, but what does the emergence of this new strain actually mean for recovery efforts?
Well, this isn't the first time we've had a variant. And unfortunately, this one we are seeing with the data at hand is a little bit more transmissible, which means it's more adept and more efficient. The hard part, though, is that when you have stressed healthcare systems and then you throw in a new variant that is spreading a bit more efficiently between people, it's inherently going to cause more stress, more disease, and potentially more deaths just because it's a numbers game at that point. You know, stress hospital plus more cases. This is just going to reinforce our need for really vigilant control measures.
Dr. Saskia Popescu is an epidemiologist at George Mason University. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
The strangest thing happened to me the other day, and I'm not exaggerating. On this city street in a Phoenix suburb, I hailed a car with my phone, and a few minutes later, an empty Chrysler minivan showed up.
So here it is.
Here it is. Yes.
And by empty, I mean empty. No one was driving it.
So what do I do? Just get in?
Yeah, just get in.
The woman you hear there is Liz Renninger, a rep from Waymo, the company that's developed this driverless car. Waymo has been testing the technology around Phoenix for a few years, and in October opened its Waymo One service to the public. So here I am, about to put my life in the hands of a robot.
So I'm opening the door here.
Yep.
Normally, I would say hello to the driver, but...
But there is no driver. That's the beauty of it.
Please make sure your seatbelt is fastened.
Yes, ma'am.
Press the help button to speak with a rider support agent.
Okay, wow. Oh my God, we're driving. Look at the front seat. Look at the front seat. There's nobody in this car but me. I'm the only person in this car. I'm sitting in the back seat, and the car is driving. That is really weird. Holy cow. All right, we're going to the golf course, the Dobson Ranch Golf Course.
In truth, I don't golf. I just needed a place to go within Waymo's 50-square-mile service area that spans the suburbs of East Phoenix. And boy, did we go. As the car turned from a residential neighborhood onto a busy 7-lane road, my heart rate started to pick up.
We're going 37 miles per hour. I feel a little out of breath, mostly because I'm kind of thrilled. I feel safe. Here we go, we're taking a right now at a big intersection. Green light, here we go. Normally I'm used to, you know, doing an interview with another person, but there's nobody else to talk to right here. It's just me. So I guess I'll just interview myself here. What does it feel like? What's it like? Well, it feels totally normal, except for that it isn't. It's completely bizarre. It's smooth, it's not jerky. I feel safe until something weird happens, I guess.
Remarkably mundane is a good way to describe it. And what you just described is pretty common.
Sashwat Panagrahi is the Waymo executive managing this project.
You see in riders the first few moments of excitement, but the car's driving profile is such that it builds trust pretty quickly. For example, it slows down just the right amount before a bump in the road coming up and so on. Would you say that's how it felt for you as well, the first few moments, and then you sort of intricately build some trust in the car?
That's right, and that's going to be one of your biggest challenges, right? Because I know on my Twitter feed when I posted a video of the first few moments in the car, so many people responded by saying, "No way, I am never going to do that." So you have to build trust, and you have to do it quickly. I'm sure you are considering that.
Absolutely, and I think we realized very early on that partial autonomy was not going to be Waymo's focus. It was going to be full autonomy, because we realized that we have to take the responsibility of that trust very seriously. And in fact, when our riders fall asleep in an autonomous ride, which has happened, we take that as a token of, you know, it's a credit. It's a testament to how smooth the drive is and so on. So I think that focus has been there for a decade, and we feel that is the safe path.
Safe because computers aren't humans. They don't get drunk. They don't get tired. Computers don't get distracted. I'm sorry. What was I saying? Anyway, in October, the company released data from 6 million miles of automated driving on Arizona roads with a backup human driver behind the wheel, and data from another 65,000 miles driven with no human in the car. In that time, Waymo vehicles were involved in 18 collisions, and Waymo predicts another 29 would have happened had the human driver not intervened. In one case, it was a pedestrian that walked into a parked Waymo minivan. But three real cases were serious enough for an airbag to deploy. As this clip from ABC News in 2018 reminds us, no system is flawless.
What happened just moments before that deadly Uber crash involving a self-driving car?
This dashcam video shows the horrifying seconds before a self-driving Uber hit and killed a pedestrian in Arizona. Tempe police released two videos Wednesday. One filming outside the car shows 49-year-old Elaine Herzberg crossing the road with her bicycle. It pauses just before the moment of impact.
That Uber crash happened 4 miles from where I picked up my ride, and it was tough not to think about it. Waymo's Sashwat Panagrahi says the company's tests still show a computer is safer than a human driver.
Unlike humans, the Waymo driver is constantly seeing 360 degrees in every direction, day or night, and as far as 3 football fields away, which enables us to detect things usually much further. So even if something is just popping out, let's say a few minutes ago, they may have been walking on the sidewalk, or there are prior cues that are available in the environment that something that's continuously monitoring and seeing 3 football fields away just has greater amount of opportunity. Let's say you are searching for parking or trying to locate the house that you're trying to visit. Your attention or your head is turned towards those house numbers or to the place that you're searching for parking. At that moment, if the object that you're mentioning were to come from the left, you know, as a human, your focus is elsewhere. The Waymo driver doesn't have any of those. Like, it's continuously perceiving things all around. It doesn't have focus, tunnel vision. It is continuously assessing the environment. So that gives an advantage.
So, what do people outside of Waymo think? I asked Missy Cummings, an expert on autonomous driving at Duke University, if she'd get into a car without a driver. The answer is, she has been.
I think the better question to ask of me and to ask of any executive in these companies are, would you put your child in there? Heck no, that's not happening.
Cummings says it's just not safe enough yet. For example, how many times has the computer been tested to recognize a quarter inch of snow on top of a stop sign? And what about a half inch?
Just that much difference in snow can dramatically change the way that the computer vision system sees the world.
I got into one of these vehicles, and it turned right into traffic, busy, oncoming traffic, and it felt safe. We didn't crash. Nothing happened. Was that a mistake that I made? Did I put myself in jeopardy?
So I think these cars can do a pretty good job with normal circumstances that it sees over and over and over again. So that is actually why the cars are geofenced in a relatively small area in Arizona is, number one, you don't have to worry about snow on stop signs. Number two, if you drive the same world over and over and over again, then you start to have that regularity and it is easier for the cars to effect safe movement. What would be a problem is if all of a sudden a dust storm came through Phoenix, which Phoenix is, they're no strangers to that.
Yeah.
That's right. And so you'll get a massive dust storm and then all the sensors are coated in some fine sand, and that's enough to degrade but not destroy the sensors, and then the sensors and software can start to make mistakes because it doesn't recognize that it's not in a world that it cannot understand. And I know that sounds like some weird double negative, but the bottom line is I don't worry about when the sensors fail. I worry about when the cars don't realize they're in over their heads.
Waymo says it's already mapped its entire service area, so the car knows where every stop sign is, whether it's snowing, raining, or blowing dust. And a self-cleaning function can wipe dirt away from the sensors. Still, the car can get in over its head.
I have felt a little bit embarrassed, like if we get stuck somewhere and people are honking.
Joel Johnson is a college student who's taken more than 80 rides with Waymo. He volunteered for the testing program when the company was still using safety drivers as a backup.
What do you mean stuck?
So like at one point I picked a spot to get picked up in front of a restaurant. It was going to try and go through the drive-thru and there were cones blocking the area and like basically, I just got in the car, I started the ride, and then it just stopped and sat there for a while. And the safety driver had to take over in that situation. But I've been trying to get it stuck. In 2020, I've been trying to get it stuck, and I just can't, because it'll always three-point turn its way out of something. Or
I still haven't found that sweet spot yet. You're trying to put it in a tough spot to see if it can successfully navigate the situation you put it in.
Yeah, I want to push the limits of the technology right now, but also be safe about it.
One day, you may have to make your own decision about being inside a car like this. Would you trust it with your life or your family's? When I rode down the arrow straight roads of Metro Phoenix, I had to ignore my fears. The ride was thrilling, and not just for me.
There's a bus here to my right.
Hi, Mr. Bus Driver! There's nobody driving!
I got a thumbs up from the bus driver when he realized there was nobody driving my car.
13 minutes or so after this wild ride started, the journey came to an end. The car pulled into the driveway of the Dobson Ranch Golf Course.
We did it!
Please check your surroundings before exiting the vehicle, and remember to close the doors after you exit.
The Waymo app charged me $6.92, and I got out in one piece. We'll have videos of my ride, pictures, and links to Waymo's safety data at hereandnow.org. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is staying in the United Kingdom for now. A judge in London has blocked a request to extradite Assange to face espionage charges in the U.S., ruling that the move would be damaging to his already fragile mental health. Joining us now for more is NPR's Frank Langfitt in the U.K. Hey, Frank.
Hi, Peter.
Hey, so the U.K. is typically pretty willing to grant extradition requests to the United States, but not in this case. How surprising was that decision?
I think people in the courtroom were completely surprised, Peter, because the judge initially was making all of these arguments that seemed to be following the U.S. prosecutors, and that was along the lines of free speech, the idea that the United States government has made that Julian Assange really wasn't acting as a journalist and there should be no, he should not be shielded because of free speech. And then towards the end, she turned around and said, but I don't think he should go there because I think he's very, very, very likely to kill himself. And then she cited in her statement a variety of neuropsychiatrists, another physician. One psychiatrist who talked to him said that Assange thought about suicide hundreds of times a day. Another quote, this is from the same neuropsychiatrist, as I am as confident as a psychiatrist ever can be that if extradition to the United States were to become imminent, Mr. Assange will find a way of suiciding. So not very ambiguous there. So she ruled to keep him here in the UK for that reason.
Right. And this was the case for a long time, because back in December of 2019, I spoke with the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture about Assange. Niels Melzer told me that he visited Assange about 3 weeks after he was arrested at the Ecuadorian embassy, where he'd been living for years, and that already at that time he was showing signs of mental decline. Let's listen.
It's a very elevated level of constant anxiety. It's not the standard anxiety any prisoner would have because he's facing criminal charge or extradition. It really is a debilitating level of anxiety and stress that comes from a profoundly arbitrary environment.
Frank, this has been a saga that has spanned a decade. Remind us how it started and some of the important twists and turns along the way.
Yeah, it really started in 2010 when WikiLeaks released all of these hundreds of thousands of pages of secret government documents. Some videos were very damaging to the Pentagon. One showed a U.S. helicopter killing at least 11 Iraqis, and a couple, including two reporters in an attack. And so the U.S. government was very angry about this and went after Assange eventually. And groups like Reporters Without Borders, they said that this was protected by the First Amendment. And ultimately, this made its way to the court after the Ecuadorian embassy here in London kicked Assange out after nearly 7 years.
He wore out his welcome. He was riding a skateboard down the hallways. But in all seriousness,
bad guest.
Yeah, but in all seriousness, he's suffering mentally, as the doctors say, and now there's still some uncertainty. So what happens now with his case? Is he going to remain in prison?
Well, I think that the U.S. government is going to appeal. There's no surprise there. And Assange's lawyers are going to ask for bail, but it may be hard to get that because this all started back in 2012 when he went to the Ecuadorian embassy. He actually skipped bail on an unrelated case. So I don't know how amenable the judges here will be to that.
All right. We'll keep an eye on that. NPR's Frank Langfitt. Thank you so much.
Great to talk, Peter.
For nearly six decades, Sir David Attenborough has been bringing us films that reveal the natural world in startling beauty and detail. And his latest work takes a sobering look at the state of our planet and our prospects for the future. The five-part series, A Perfect Planet, looks at how weather, ocean currents, and the sun and volcanoes have shaped the world we live in.
Volcanoes are certainly destructive. But without these powerful underground forces, there would be no breathable atmosphere, no oceans, no land, no life.
A Perfect Planet is available via streaming on Discovery Plus beginning today, and Sir David Attenborough joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Also joining us is executive producer Alistair Fothergill. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
Yes, so let's start with you, Sir David. As you say in the film, Earth, as we know it, is uniquely suited to sustain life. It is the perfect planet. Say more.
Well, in many ways, of course, it's self-defining, isn't it? We're here because the Earth is suitable, and the Earth is suitable because we're here. And it is an extraordinarily complex system, and we often forget the component parts of it. And by examining the natural world in terms of the sunlight, the volcano, the seas, you are looking at it in a more fundamental way and seeing how we are dependent upon those and what extraordinary powers they are and how lucky we are that they are within the limits which suit us as human life. But Alistair is the great architect of the series, and he can speak more fluently about it than I can.
Yes, Alistair, as you gather these stunning images of creatures that live near volcanoes or in cliffs by oceans or in the Arctic, I can imagine at the front of your mind as well was also how long these creatures might be able to survive given the rapidly changing nature of this perfect planet.
It was very important to us to consider whether the wonderful balance, how these forces who for millions of years have created this perfect planet, whether we have upset this balance. I mean, when you look at the fires in California, you look at the fact that the hurricanes that are hitting the east coast of the United States are more regular and more powerful. You have to question whether these are small blips or there is a genuine concern that we have upset the perfect planet. And that is what we wanted to address in this series, and particularly actually in the fifth episode, which looks at that and also looks at the solutions, because it's very, very important that we empower people with the possible solutions to the problems we presently face.
Oh, say more about that, because yes, for listeners, this last episode, you focus solely on human activity.
Well, the thing about human activity, if you were to say what is the human activity that most affects the other forces, the weather, the ocean currents, and that it's the production of CO2. We now create more CO2 in a year than all the volcanoes, 100 times more than all the volcanoes put together. And if you look back at the history of our planet, there have been five great extinctions, and all but the last one were basically created by too much CO2.
Sir David, your thoughts on this? I mean, you've been telling stories of the natural world for over six decades. What are some of the greatest changes that you've seen?
Well, I suppose actually the greatest change that I've seen with my own eyes is off your shores of the northeast coast of your continent. I've seen dead coral reefs, and that's a terrible, terrible sight. Since a living coral reef is, in my estimation, the most astonishing, wondrous community of animals on the planet, suddenly see it replaced by a stark white cemetery is profoundly moving.
It is quite astounding when we see the changes to the coral reefs. This series is a call for action on climate change. How optimistic, Sir David, are you about the prospects of action being taken?
I think that the COP meeting, the United Nations climate meeting, which is taking place in Glasgow in Scotland, is of crucial importance for the future of this humanity. It's our last chance to get it right. We've been saying this is the last chance again and again, but this time it really is our last chance. If we don't fix it this time, we are going to be in real trouble. We know how to fix it. All we have to do is to sort out amongst ourselves what we're going to deal with and to get onto looking at things internationally and globally instead of nationally and parochially. My feeling is that people of the world are willing politicians, are urging politicians to get together and sort this out as a team, a united team. We're all on the same side of trying to help the natural world. Nationalism is over, or should be.
At the same time, there are those who deny that it's happening, and many of those are in power, and they continue to push for the use of fossil fuels. How do you reach those people?
Difficult to know, but one of them has been defeated at the polls. And indeed, when I heard the news of President-elect Biden, one of the first public pronouncements he made was that the United States would rejoin the Paris Agreement. I stood up and cheered because it was the most important decision that I'd heard, certainly that week, if not that month, if not that year.
Alistair, this series is airing during a time of global crisis with the coronavirus. Did this affect putting the show together?
Not that much. We'd completed most of our filming by March last year. It takes over a year to post-produce a big series like this. I think the biggest challenge, actually, was recording David's narration. Normally, he would come to Bristol and record in a dubbing theatre. But we had to do it, the sound recorders had to go up to his house on the outskirts of London and pass a carefully sterilised microphone through the window. And we actually communicated with David by Zoom so he could see the pictures. And we actually recorded an amazing narration. And to be honest, I think nobody who didn't know that we had got round COVID in this way would have realised at all that it wasn't a normal narration recorded in the normal way in a professional dubbing theatre.
Sir David, I'm really struck by thinking of you standing up with excitement at hearing that President-elect Biden is now our incoming president. But how do you think this show about the crisis of climate change will resonate at this time as the world is really caught up with this coronavirus pandemic and just trying to slow the spread?
The world is one. Humanity is one lot. The coronavirus has infected you and New Zealand just as it infected us and Europe. And if we're going to deal with the virus, we have to have people who are going to deal with it with the vaccine, which have been doing both in America and in this country and elsewhere. We can get together to deal with a universal global problem. It is an example of what we need to do, but on a much, much greater scale globally. And so it should inspire us into action and give us optimism, give us hope, rather than the reverse.
I think it's also important to add that although the fifth episode deals very boldly with the challenge of climate change, the opening four episodes are about the perfect planet and this amazing balance of natural forces and the natural history that supports. And I think it's really important, actually, when people get locked away in their very urban existences, that what we can provide with a series like A Perfect Planet is an escape. We can show them that although the planet is challenged, there remain some amazing, beautiful spectacles still out there. And it still is a perfect planet. For how long? We don't know. But the series is much more than just a hard message about climate change. It really is a celebration of the perfect planet as well.
One final question for you, Sir David. You started an Instagram account to coincide with the release of your documentary, A Life on Our Planet, and very quickly picked up over 6 million followers. Young environmental activists are pleading for you not to drop it. Do you think you'll be able to maintain it?
No, I'm a child of my time. I don't live happily in social media. I get about between 50 and 70 letters a day, and that's quite enough for me to deal with. To start going onto the social media as well is something I couldn't cope with.
Well, it really shows you don't have to garner interest. Folks are already there along with you. Sir David Attenborough and Alistair Fothergill, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed.
A Perfect Planet is available on Discovery Plus.
Today, it's back to work and back to school time for many Americans, even though aside from frontline workers, many people aren't really going back to any place. They'll continue to work and learn remotely, like me, sitting alone here in my home office, speaking to you, my sixth grade daughter in the room next to me on a Zoom call. Many of us are also eating, shopping, sipping coffee, and watching movies from home. And our next guest says that means a whole lot for the fabric of our communities. Derek Thompson is a staff writer at The Atlantic, and he joins us now from Washington, as he does each Monday. Derek, welcome back.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Sure. And you remind us of the political scientist Robert Putnam, who for years, even before the pandemic, was chronicling the decline in civic engagement, fewer people in bowling leagues, lower church attendance. And here we are now in the middle of this pandemic. How much has the virus accelerated a trend that was already happening?
That's exactly what it's done. These trends were absolutely already happening before the virus hit. And I know this because I got a galley of Putnam's latest book, The Upswing, the week before the pandemic essentially shut down the Atlantic's office. And I'm reading this book, and it's describing all of these trends that are pointing toward a withering of community. You have lower marriage rates, he found, lower church attendance, lower trust in government, falling membership in chapter-based associations, collapsing social trust. All of this was already happening before the pandemic, I would say, accelerated these trends. And so that's really what I thought was so interesting, is that the pandemic was not a clean break with the world that existed in 2019, the beginning of 2020. It accelerated this sort of fragmentation of the American community.
Well, you quote someone in your recent piece in The Atlantic as saying, the definition of community is where you keep showing up. And I have to say, Derek, that struck me because my wife and I have been talking for months now about how hard it is to meet people anymore. How do you make a new friend in a pandemic, let alone meet anyone, if you're not showing up anywhere? And what are the implications of that?
Yeah, you know, my wife and I have had the exact same conversation as we have sat alone in our apartment a couple hundred miles south of where you and your wife are having the exact same conversation. I keep coming back to that line. Community is where you keep showing up. It's a lovely idea, but it's also somewhat haunting idea, because where do people keep showing up these days? The answer is nowhere other than their living rooms and their bedrooms. Not in the office, not in the COVID aerosolized bars and gyms, not in movie theaters. A lot of people have spent the last 9 months, 10 months finding community via the glowing screen of the room they almost never leave. And I think that could have implications. I'm certainly hopeful that when we're all vaccinated, we'll spring back into those bars and restaurants and gyms. But I also think that there might be a little bit of a subtle undertow, a relic of this year of plague that somewhat changes the way that we think about how communities are and should be formed.
We'll go back to movie theaters for just a moment. You write about Warner Brothers announcing last month that subscribers to its streaming service HBO Max will be able to watch films released in the theater from home on the same day. And that completely epitomizes what we're talking about and how we will be living our lives, doesn't it?
I really think it does. You know, I grant that it might sound like to some people like a complete non sequitur, you know, the pandemic on the one hand and streaming entertainment on the other. But let me try to make the connection concrete. At the center of reality is our attention. At the center of community is our attention. And as communities are fragmenting, our attention is fragmenting as well. You go back 80 years, in the 1940s, the average American bought 30 movie tickets a year. That's about one movie ticket every 2 weeks. When they did watch TV, a medium that really took off in the 1950s, they watched in a handful of channels. They were watching the same thing at the same time as all of their friends and all their neighbors. But what we've seen certainly in the last 10 years is really a Cambrian explosion, not just of channels where you can watch whatever you want in your own time, but also newsletters, podcasts, and so on. HBO Max's decision, I see, is very much keeping with this trend. You know, they say when you want to watch a movie in the future, you don't have to come together in some movie theater to do it. You can remain apart. And on the one hand, this is the height of convenience, and there's aspects of this that I think are wonderful when it comes to allowing people to watch entertainment conveniently. But again, I urge people to look at the bigger picture. What is happening to our attention? It is becoming as fragmented as elements of our communities. And I think that we are seeing in the political sphere some evidence of what can happen when our attention does fragment. It means that we can live in these choose-your-own-adventures where we can't agree on basic facts of democratic life, like who won the election in November. You have a huge part of the country that doesn't believe that Joe Biden is the legally elected or elected next president of the United States. So I do think that the fragmenting of attention is a huge story, and one that I'm following for the following year.
And Derek, I have about 30 seconds here, but you do say you're ecstatically optimistic about 2021, even after all this. Quickly, please.
Absolutely. Look, attention is one part of reality, but you know, so is our health. The vaccines are coming, and I'm optimistic about the vaccines. I'm optimistic about the future of restaurants bouncing back. I cannot wait to go back to my favorite bars. There is so much to look forward to, but there is also, yes, this line of darkness.
Derek Thompson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here Now.
Anti-death penalty activist and Catholic nun Sister Helen Prejean talks about the Trump administration's revival of federal executions. That's next time on Here and Now.